Greetings. Welcome to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. I'm Greg Coleridge, Director of the Economic and Political Justice Program. As always, we hope this resource informs you about issues you feel are important, but not hearing elsewhere, updates you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspires you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that create real change. It is Friday, February the 13th. Tomorrow, of course, is Valentine's Day, a day dedicated to love, a tagline often connected with AFSC, sort of a slogan, if you will, over the years has been, quote, to see what love can do, unquote. Love in the context that AFSC has used that in doesn't specifically refer to love between parents and children or intimate love or even friendship, all three of which have very distinct separate words in Greek and probably other languages as well. The love that AFSC refers to is what the Greeks call agape, goodwill or charity toward all, and that certainly seeks what AFSC seeks to do in through its education, advocacy, and organizing to bring goodwill and charity toward all. This week's podcast features, as always, reports from last week's activities, what's coming up this next week, and reflections on current AFSC issue-related news items. Last week, this previous week, was a very busy one. I was out of the Northeast Ohio area for a few days, Monday through Wednesday at Miami University, where I spoke to a variety of different audiences and venues, beginning Monday evening, the 9th, a campus-wide program, about 250 students, faculty, some community members there, on the topic of our government is broken because the system is fixed, creating a real democracy movement. This was sponsored by a number of campus organizations, predominantly, though, by a memorial group called the Robert E. Stripple Memorial Continuing Dialogue on Justice and Human Rights. Very fascinating gathering, very good energy. There is a very active group in the community of Oxford working on Move to Amend, which is looking and successfully reaching out to the campus community. So they were doing all they could to spread the word and bringing people in. So it was a very, very successful evening. It was followed by Tuesday and Wednesday with campus talks and classes. I don't know, four or five classes spoken, plus a luncheon and a dinner at the Oxford Peace and Justice Center. And then an evening program in town sponsored by the Move to Amend affiliate or partner group called Take Back Democracy, as well as the Butler County, that's where Oxford is located, in Butler County Progressive PAC. They are all working pretty substantially and with great conviction and effectiveness in organizing locally to introduce a resolution in city council in the near future. So that was Monday through Wednesday. On Thursday, last evening, was the a public meeting of Radio Free Akron at the Highland Square Library. Its purpose was just to sort of provide a Q&A and share where we are with anyone in the community. Very good turnout, good energy, number of people inquired and picked up the application to organize and sponsor and produce a program. And that certainly is a possibility. You can go to radiofreeakron.org, and there on the webpage is a application that, I think they said it was not yet going to be on, but soon will be. Watch for that in the next couple of days. Check out the Radio Free Akron Facebook page for up-to-date information about that as well. There are certainly lots of possibilities for involvement and participation from organizing and helping arrange the programming to setting up the operations, which is the antenna, setting up the studio, securing the equipment. It's at this point largely, almost exclusively a volunteer operation, so we certainly need all the help we can get. There's also a link on the webpage to donations. If you are supportive of that, we certainly welcome that. We need about 15 grand to get this thing off the ground, and we've got about four, I think. So we still have a ways to go, and August 1st is the deadline for us to get on the air. So more about Radio Free Akron in the weeks ahead. Well, coming up this next week are several events and activities, all of which are open to the public. So if any of these are anywhere near you and you have interest in, feel free to participate in. Although the last item is actually a conference call, so you can be anywhere, actually, and participate in that. Tuesday, the 17th, is in Newburgh Heights, the village of Newburgh Heights, there. Democracy Day public hearing, which was something created following passage of their ballot initiative a couple of years ago, calling for a move to amend constitutional amendment and corporate personhood and money of speech. That hearing will take place in the Newburgh Heights Village Hall at 6 p.m. at their address, 4000 Washington Park Boulevard. That is on the 17th at 6:30. I can't be in two places at once, but we have been helping the Talmadge Move to Amend, a group that seeks to become a formal affiliate. They will be meeting at the Talmadge Public Library. This will be their third meeting, and they are making good progress. So if you can't make it to Newburgh Heights but are anywhere near Talmadge and want to help that effort off the ground, they want to get something on the ballot if they don't get something through council, but they prefer to do a ballot initiative for this November. So they certainly would welcome any support. Wednesday, the 18th at 7 p.m., is the next meeting of the South Euclid Move to Amend effort. That will be taking place at a private residence, 873 Haywood Drive, but again, is open to the public. But if you do plan to attend, please RSVP 440-542-0537. That is 440-542-0537, the number to one of the coordinators of the effort in South Euclid, Diane Mullally. Her number again, 440-542-0537. That is at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. On the agenda will be draft language of their initiative petition that they seek to get on the ballot for this November, but requires several hundred signatures of registered voters in Euclid, South Euclid, to achieve that. On the 19th at 8 p.m. is the monthly Move to Amend Ohio statewide conference call, open to anyone, whether you're formally connected to Move to Amend yet or want to be. To find out what's going on all over the state, including our upcoming statewide annual gathering, which will be the third one at the end of March. That would be March 28th in Columbus. So certainly that will be one of the agenda items. If you're interested in listening in, participating, finding out more, you're certainly welcome to do that. That is going to be at 8 o'clock, usually lasts no longer than 1 hour. Phone call to dial in is 215-241-7110 or toll free 866-318-6943. The access code is 78381213. So toll-free, 866-318-6943, and access code 78381213. Finally, we turn to the part of our weekly podcast where we comment on various news items, issues, or announce social actions that we have an interest in some way, shape, or form, either currently or coming up. And one of those issue areas is the budget, federal budget, and of course, the huge piece of that, disproportionately large, is the military part of the budget. Recently, an article by Raed Jahar, who is the policy impact coordinator in the Washington office of AFSC, appeared on Common Dreams and is, I think, worth lifting up. The title of that article is B is for Billion, What Military Cuts? With a question mark. The article about trying to understand and to describe the get our heads wrapped around the total amount of money spent on the military, the total amount, which is, of course, far greater than the amount allotted to the so-called Department of Defense. And I intentionally say so-called because we need, you know, language is so very important. It shapes how we frame things and what we think about things and how much we trust or distrust, how much we accept or don't accept, and the like. And the reality is, not just an opinion, but a fact, is going back from day one of this country to, I think it was 1947, what we know of today is the Department of Defense was at that time, for most of our nation's history, called the Department of War. And the head of that department was called the Secretary of War. And the amount of money allocated to that department, headed up by that person, was the war budget. I think in the name of, in the spirit of truth in advertising, if you will, that's really what it should go back to, because that's what its purpose has been largely, not to defend, but to aggressively pursue actions well beyond the borders of the United States, framed Orwellian as defense and pursuing our national interests, whatever that means, which oftentimes has meant corporate interests and the interests of the power elite to expand empire. And there isn't anything, any other country that remotely comes close, anywhere near the amount of foreign military bases, troops, weapons deployed beyond our nation's border. Historically, it is greater than even the British Empire. No empire in the history of the planet has been as widespread as the current empire. And it is about not so much defense as it is maintaining through intimidation and, when need be, opening fire to promote aggression to maintain the interests, which basically are not most interests of most people in this country, but that of a few. Anyway, that's a sidebar, off track, but nevertheless, important that we call things as they are, reflecting their true purpose and mission and function. Well, Raed, in his article, talks about how hard it is to follow the budget amounts. What started out, for example, last year as a proposed $56 billion cut, remember, under the thing called the sequestration, in which to deal with the budget deficit, Congress passed an equal reduction, supposedly, on both domestic and the military sides of the budget. But they whittled it away over time. What started out, you know, more like a couple years ago of sequestration, got whittled down through different gyrations and incarnations to where it ended up being only $3.6 billion. Department of Defense spending alone, that was a cut, $3.6 billion cut. So what started out as a $56 billion cut ended up just being, last year, $3.6 billion. But even that is, what we know of is just the Department of Defense or Department of War spending is misleading. The official Pentagon spending or Department of Defense spending was $495 billion, but that does not reflect the true cost of what we call military preparation and the like, because it does not include the cost of nuclear weapons, which is under the Department of Energy. When you add that in, the total amount of money for the military is actually $665 billion, far greater than the $495 billion, which amounts to $665 billion, 57% of this year's discretionary spending. That means out of every dollar, as we mentioned last week as well, but just bears repeating, for every dollar that is spent by Congress, that the Congress has the authority to spend, 57 cents of it will go toward the military. The rest, less than 43%, will cover everything else: education, environmental protection, job training, scientific research, transportation, economic development programs, a bunch of low-income assistance programs, you name it. But that's still not the total. It does not include other items that fall under the larger and wider umbrella called national security budget. When you add in the Pentagon expenses, the military, to other things for Veterans Affairs, non-Department of Defense national security, and the share of the interest on our national debt that was caused by military spending and military wars and occupations, the number in 2015 is actually not even $665 billion, but more like $1,009 billion, or $1.009 trillion. Far greater than the formal Department of Defense or Department of War spending budgetary item alone. In fact, double that. That's what we're up against. That's the amount of money that is being spent, our tax dollars, in our name for those purposes. And what we pay for is usually what we get. And what we don't pay for also is usually what we get. And by not investing in people, in our own economy, in providing health, safety, and welfare of people, and humane and sane foreign aid abroad, not military aid, not weapons and the like, we basically get what we invest in. And it is not a very, very pretty picture. But it does certainly call for us to do what we can when we can, if we are so inclined and so moved. And this is certainly the season for it, between now and tax day, when the budget gets its fair hearing, for us to weigh in. And certainly we invite you to contact your congressperson, your senators, Brown and Portman, and whoever your congressperson is, and share with them your views of what you believe our national priorities, federal budget priorities, should be. Well, President Obama this week, a second item, said that he'd love, as reported, he'd love a constitutional amendment addressing campaign spending. He said in a February 9th interview, quote, "I would love to see some constitutional process that would allow us to actually regulate campaign spending the way we used to, and maybe even improve it," unquote. I don't know, maybe his whole love for such a constitutional amendment coincides with the fact that it is Valentine's week. Who knows? But nevertheless, it, on the one hand, is a certainly somewhat of a shocker, but he certainly indicated, when was it, many years ago, following the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, the first State of the Union address following that decision. If you recall, he spoke about it in very negative terms. And has made some offhanded references in the past about the issue, but this was pretty blatant. Maybe part of the inspiration or motivation for his comments was the realization by him, as well as so many others, that the amount of money that is being spent in elections is just exploding. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, just looking at the last two presidential election cycles, between 2008 and 2012, the amount of money that was spent by outside groups, and it was outside groups that were given the green light under the Citizens United decision to spend, namely well-to-do individuals and corporations, would fund these so-called independent outside groups that could not directly endorse or oppose candidates, but they sort of did so indirectly. And funds for those kinds of groups just exploded, almost tripled, from $338 million in 2008 to over $1 billion in 2012. So that certainly is in part the inspiration, and of course that amount of money, the amount of money between the last several midterm elections, the last one being, of course, in 2014, has also dramatically increased. Well, so what the president seemed to allude to is that he would be open to a constitutional amendment that might look something like what was proposed by the Senate last year, and in fact made it through the Senate, passed by a majority, did not have the 60 votes, however, to withstand a filibuster. But still, what that proposal called for was to reverse Citizens United and, in fact, to revisit the Buckley decision. As far as that goes, and as good as that may be, it certainly is, on the one hand, quite an acknowledgement of what Move to Amend and others who have been trying to raise this issue from obscurity and supposedly irrelevancy to say, wait a second, this is a very relevant issue and is now getting credibility because the president's talking about it and others are talking about it and the Senate even dealt with it. So it is a legitimate issue and it does connect to so many other issues, and that so many of the concerns we have around individual economic or collective economic concerns and injustices and social injustices and political injustices are directly connected to these concerns. However, the problem associated with what the president is suggesting, and in fact what the Congress, namely the Senate, passed, is that it only addresses a portion of the problem. If the president woke up tomorrow morning and miraculously everything that he wished for, that he's talking about, namely what the Senate passed, was miraculously enacted, it still would not cover the totality of the usurpation or the hijacking or the capturing of government, of decision-making by a certain small, select, elite number of special interests, namely corporate entities. Because what would still remain on the books would be virtually every single one of the never-intended inalienable constitutional rights that the courts had passed, beginning way back in the 1800s right up to the present time. With the exception, apparently, if this, what the Senate passed last year and what the president seems to be calling for was passed, corporate entities would not have First Amendment inalienable rights. They could not donate, at least have the right to donate. Whatever rights or privileges they would have would be a question of legislation. But again, as Move to Amend has promoted and has said all along, we're only going to get one crack at this. We're only, realistically, it's tough enough to pass a constitutional amendment. Do we really think we can pass four or five in 5 or 6 years in a row? It doesn't work that way. We're only going to get one crack at it. And if we still keep, so to speak, on the books, the ability of corporations to use or misuse the Fourth Amendment, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and 14th Amendment constitutional rights, these entities, particularly the 14th Amendment, was the preferred weapon of choice of corporations to overturn and assault democratically enacted laws, rules and regulations, labor laws and consumer laws and the like, for decades across this country, state by state. They'll just simply pull that hammer, that weapon, out of their bag again if they can't use the First Amendment, which has been their preferred weapon of choice in recent times, ever since they acquired First Amendment free speech rights. But, okay, so they don't have that at their disposal. They'll just go back and use the 14th Amendment. Actually, nor would it include, if the president got what he wanted and the Senate got what they wanted, the First Amendment right not to speak. So Monsanto could still argue communities or even states like Vermont that want to impose laws and mandate that genetically modified organisms have to be listed on products, you know, labeled on products, that would still remain, because the defense that Monsanto corporations have used and are talking about going to court over and have in the past gone to court over is their right, First Amendment right, not to speak. So that's different from First Amendment right to speak that maybe might be eliminated if the Senate got what they wanted. The basic bottom line in all of this, as we have said, but it bears repeating over and over because, you know, those guys keep sort of selling themselves out short over and over, is we're only going to get one crack at it. We shouldn't censor ourselves. We shouldn't edit ourselves. We shouldn't sell ourselves short. We need to have a solution that is commensurate to the problem. And the problem is money is speech and corporations are persons. Thus, a constitutional amendment needs to include both provisions. Well, turning now to an article. Interesting, there have been a couple of articles that have been in the press over the last week or two related to what bankers and, you know, those inside the banking industry are saying about the health or lack thereof of the economy. You know, while corrupt bank and bankers over the years have oftentimes kept two sets of books, you know, one for the public or shareholders to view and the other internal that describes how the company is actually doing, there appears increasingly to be banks now issuing two sets of statements about the overall health of the economy, one for public consumption in the general press to allay comms that, oh, everything is great, the economy is booming, look at the stock market. Just, you know, good times are here again. But many bankers internally to their own investors are raising red flags and saying the economy is going to decline in 2015. Citibank, for example, has issued a statement recently that has said that the price of oil may go as low as $20 a barrel. It's now 50. Of course, it was over 110. Not all that long ago, as of middle of or early part of last year. And they're saying, look, it's due to excess supply from all the incredible cheap money that was available. You know, the Federal Reserve issued all of this money through the quantitative easing program. It just flooded the market, so it made it available, and it resulted in oil and gas drillers, including shale drillers, but also fracking, those who want to be involved in horizontal drilling of fracking right here in Ohio, to get cheap money to invest in equipment. And so they acquired all this equipment, began to do all of this drilling, and now with the prices dropping, I mean, part of what happened was all of this drilling resulted in a booming amount of supply. Well, hey, simple law of supply and demand. If you've got a lot of supply, it means the average price of whatever it is you're supplying is not going to be as high. So that's one cause of it. And then the other is, of course, declining demand. As the economies and as wages have stagnated and the like, look, if you don't have people wanting to buy, wanting to drive, wanting to shop, you're just simply not going to have a big demand for stuff. And so if you don't have much demand, then you don't need much supply. So the oil industry is being hit in both directions. Too much supply, not enough demand, low prices we are going to see. And part of that has to do, according to Citibank, with just the overall decline of the economy. Goldman Sachs analysts are projecting that sales growth for S&P 500 companies will be near zero for all of 2015. And according to Bank of America, the global economy will actually shrink by several trillion dollars in 2015. So never mind stagnating, it is going to go in reverse. So I just found a couple of those things interesting between sort of the differentiation between what a lot of times banks say publicly and or externally and what they're saying to their own people internally. Banks may, in fact, have overplayed their hand fighting Wall Street, according to an article that appeared this week. As was mentioned a couple of times maybe, last year, just before Congress recessed for the holiday, they included in their budget bill a provision, a nice little rider, that gave banks their risky, what are called derivatives, that are these bets on bets, highly risky, highly susceptible. And oftentimes, those that fall on their face. So it's kind of a hedge in which, you know, if you think something is going to go up but you're not quite sure, then you spend some money betting that it's going to go down just to kind of cover yourself. Well, there's trillions of these bets on bets out there, these derivatives, that have been, again, in part because of all the free money that banking corporations received from the Federal Reserve through this quantitative easing program. They just started betting on everything they could think of. Well, they're worried that in part because of the oil decline, a lot of those bets were on, oh, price of oil are going to just keep going up, up, and up. Well, they are probably sitting on trillions of dollars of losses so far that they haven't turned in because they're hoping the market turns around. Anyway, there was a rider in that bill, in the budget bill, that said that these derivatives should be, if they go bad, shouldn't be swallowed by the company or the company's investors, but should be backed up by Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation program. That's the public program that's supplied by your tax dollars and mine that's supposed to be there available to bail out depositors in the case that banks go belly up. So it's meant to be for depositors, not for banks themselves who take advantage of these risky loans. Well, anyway, there's been supposedly, according to Bloomberg anyway, amid the business press, quite a backlash and a pushback. The banks just may have been so greedy that they have overplayed their hand as a result of that rider, that now you're having even more modest, you know, pretty modest so-called reforms or changes to the Dodd-Frank Act that was the post-2007-2008 when the economy imploded due to the banking recession inspired or the like, following the subprime crisis, and the banks went, many of them lost billions of dollars. The government came in, rescued them through the TARP program, but also created this so-called Reform Act, the Dodd-Frank Act. That was pretty watered down to begin with, but nevertheless had some provisions. Well, the banking lobbyists have been working aggressively to, you know, periodically slice away this regulation, that regulation, and the like. Well, even that now, according to Bloomberg, has shut down. That Democrats that in the Senate that were in and in the House favorable to this, that, you know, received quite a bit of money from the banking industry, as well as, of course, Republicans that received maybe a little bit more. They both now are because of the backlash, public backlash, and many Democrats that haven't been bought, rented, leased, or retained by the banking industry are saying, we're not going to go along with anything. And so it is shut down, and the Wall Street crowd are somewhat at wits, at least temporarily. So to slow down the train of getting rid of regulations is obviously a good thing. So anyway, that's an interesting piece I ran into. In the area of inequality, a couple of stats, a few quotes, and a couple proposals. America's top in the stats category, according to some latest figures, America's top 0.01% of taxpayers, those who make over $8.4 million, pulled in 4.48% of U.S. income in 2013, an analysis of new IRS data shows. That compares, in 1978, it was five times less. So from 78 to 2013, the amount percentage-wise that the top 100th of 1%, the super-duper rich of Americans, have taken in more than five times than they did before. The 100 biggest campaign donors in the 2014 U.S. elections gave $323 million, notes Politico, almost as much as the $356 million politicians took in from everyone who contributed under $200. So 100 donors contributed almost, or investors, contributed almost as much as everyone else, which is 4.75 million people. 100 persons, donors, investors versus 4.75 million. A few quotes. Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO on the issue of equality, has said, "We are tired of people talking about inequality as if nothing can be done," unquote. And it's true. There's a certain sense of inevitability and irreversibility to it. Well, no, it has been done, was created, it can be uncreated. Robert Johnson, a former hedge fund director, speaking at the Davos World Economic Forum last month, said, quote, "I know hedge fund managers all over the world who are buying airstrips and farms in places like New Zealand because they think they need a getaway," unquote. They're understanding that the gap between rich and poor is reaching near crisis proportions. Well, in the proposal category, a couple of proposals that have been introduced, one in Congress, one suggested by the president, neither of which will be seriously, no doubt, heard from, but nevertheless are out there, can be built upon, advocated for, amended. The president introduced under his new federal budget something, a provision that would raise taxes on capital gains income and eliminate what's called the step-up loophole that lets America's wealthiest avoid paying capital gains taxes on their assets. So this was something that, if enacted, would save for families earning $25,000 or less, $175 a year, and it would raise taxes on the nation's top one-tenth of 1%, households making at least $3.4 million a year by an average of $168,000. A second proposal that promoted by Representative Chris Van Hollen from Maryland has proposed an action plan to grow the paychecks of all, not just the wealthiest few. His plan would deny corporations tax deductions on any executive pay over $1 million if their workers aren't getting pay hikes, quote, that reflect increases in worker productivity and the cost of living, unquote. Also appearing in the same package by Representative Van Hollen is a financial transaction tax on Wall Street speculation. So anytime you want to bet, like these derivatives, $100, you know, you've got to give, say, a dollar to this fund. That I mean, given all the speculation and bets on bets and currencies going up, you know, at 10:04 and then at 10:05 they say the currency is going to go down. Anytime they invest $100, you know, $1 or $2 has got to go into this fund. And what that would do, obviously, is raise money, but also it would deter speculation, which, you know, there's a difference between investing in a company that means you want to put money into a company that's going to use that money to produce, you know, innovation or update capital equipment or whatever, versus just speculating, moving money in and out of accounts just to try to take advantage on the little margin, thinking again that that currency is going to go up or that stock is, you know, going to move a little bit, and all you're doing is moving money around. All right, lastly, on fast track, we have made mention previously many times about the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and other so-called misnamed, mislabeled, misrepresented trade deals, a European equivalent of it called TTIP, Trans-Pacific or Transatlantic Trade Agreement. Both of these really are conditioned. If they have any choice of getting through Congress, they have got to have something called fast track passed first, because this would permit the president to sign these agreements and would permit these being approved without basically much, if any, congressional input in terms of looking at them, in terms of asking questions, in terms of determining what impacts these deals would have on health, the economy, communities, the planet, in terms of amending them. None of that would be possible if Fast Track is approved. Well, next Monday is President's Day. Congress has off all week. Supposedly, the word is that when Congress gets back from that week holiday or vacation or whatever it is, that they will be seeing a fast-track bill that will be introduced by pro-fast-track types in both houses of Congress and supported by the president. We know that previous trade deals like NAFTA have done horrific things in terms of outsourcing jobs and lowering wages, blocking efforts to protect health, public health. It's expanded inequality, it's increased the deficit, and while NAFTA has continues to be bad for the average person in all three countries, the TPP is just a whole new breed, what some call NAFTA on steroids, because it allows, as we have mentioned many times before, it allows companies to directly challenge laws that they deem an impediment to trade. that have been enacted democratically at the nation state level, relatively speaking, of course, democratically, to whatever extent we have a democratic decision-making process. But that's a whole other question, which we have examined and will continue to do so. Nevertheless, relatively speaking, how laws get enacted in our country is a whole lot more inclusive than it would be under the TPP. And the TPP has been pushed through as a secret agreement. Most Congress people haven't even had a chance to look at it. It's blatantly unconstitutional as well as being undemocratic and needs to be fought back. And the first step, an important step and critical step in doing that, in resisting the TPP, is to prevent Fast Track from being enacted. And so here's our chance to do that. The bill itself, once introduced in Congress, which again will probably happen a week after the presidential day week vacation, it'll be introduced. And once introduced, it must pass the Senate Finance Committee and House Ways and Means Committee, as well as then votes in both the Senate and the House. These things can move quickly. They're going to try to fast track, again, before people can sort of figure out what the heck's going on. So it's very important that we be vigilant and persistent. What you need to do is, obviously, you know, two things. One is call your member of Congress during next week, during the week of the 15th in particular, to the 21st. There's a number of places to go to. A place I like is stopfasttrack.com. Stopfasttrack.com. That's one of the organizations that has been working on this quite a bit. They developed a whole campaign called Flush the TPP. I think maybe that has its own website, flushthetpp.com or .org as well. But your congressperson, your senators need to be called. AFSC is going to be looking at doing an action here in the near future, along with some other groups in both Akron and or Cleveland, to try to bring this whole issue to light. That is all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Our website is afsc.org/Akron. Facebook page, facebook.com/NEOAFSC. Program blog, northeastohioafsc.wordpress.com. My blog, createrealdemocracy.wordpress.com. Till next week, onward for justice, peace, and democracy.